This is the Winchester Talking Newspaper for the week ending Friday, 4th of November 2016. Hello and welcome to this week's edition of the Hampshire Chronicle from the Winchester and District newspaper. Liz and Gordon Legg have edited extracts this week. We'll begin with the usual regular notices, and the first is to say that if you know someone who's sight impaired and would like to receive our recordings, or if you have a problem with the recording that you've received from us, please telephone Irene Dowding on 01962 870 370. That's 01962 870 370. Just to remind you that you can use the buttons on your box to move on from an item before it finishes or back to any of the tracks if you want to listen again. And just one more reminder, and that's for those of you with computers or tablets. As well as using your memory stick in the box, you can also access the weekly recording of the Chronicle through our website, www.winchestertalkingnews.com. That's all lowercase, no spaces. www.winchestertalkingnews.com. Just go to the website and click on News on the header bar. Locate the recording you want to hear and click Download. The recordings are listed in date order, with the most recent first on the list. And on to this week's edition of the Hampshire Chronicle. Our readers today are Claire Porter.
Hello.
Richard Martin.
Hello.
And Gerry Tough.
Hello.
And I'm your presenter this week, Ros Lydiard. So let's move on to the news. The leading headlines this week are Cultural City Vision, Judges Deny Killer's Appeal Application, and Welcome Boost for the Carriage Cafe Plan. And the first headline story is from Claire, please.
Culture City Vision, a World Heritage Site. That is the dream for Winchester of Alan Lovell and the Hampshire Cultural Trust. Mr. Lovell, the Trust Chairman, has outlined his vision for Winchester to be celebrated and promoted as a place of vital significance in the development of England, the language, and English culture. If attained, it would be a massive publicity boost for the city and the tourist industry. He said, "We believe Winchester has undersold its fantastic history. It should be a World Heritage Site, but the powers that be may think we already have too many walled Western cities." Mr. Lovell said the Trust would aim to highlight the period from 870 to 1170 that covers King Alfred, Hyde Abbey, the Hospital of St. Cross, the Cathedral, Wolvesey Palace, and the development of the Winchester Bible in the 1160s. He said the Trust would work with the Cathedral, City and County Council, as well as groups such as Hyde 900 and the English Project. A purpose-built museum was needed, perhaps combined with a purpose-built music space and theatre, he said. There are four possible sites in the city: Silver Hill, the car park off Colebrook Street, Station Approach, or River Park if the leisure centre moves to Bar End. The Trust has budgeted £1.1 million between 2016-2020 to develop its ideas. This could be something very remarkable for our city, he said. He said he was unsure at the moment whether to include the Centre for English Identity, the new institution at Winchester University, run by former MP John Denham. World Heritage Sites are designated by the United Nations Educational, Scientific and Cultural Organization, UNESCO. There are currently 30 in the UK, including Stonehenge, the city of Bath, Canterbury Cathedral, and the Jurassic coast of Dorset and Devon. Later, the packed church heard a talk by linguist Professor David Crystal on how King Alfred sounded, speaking Old English, a Germanic language that developed into the English we speak today. Mr. Lovell spoke on the eve of the Winchester A Nation Emerges symposium at the Guildhall that attracted major speakers such as Professor Michael Wood, TV presenter, and Professor Martin Biddle, the man who led several important digs in the city centre between 1950s and 1970s. In 2017, the Cultural Trust will hold a 3-day conference in the city.
Judges deny killer's appeal application. The man jailed for life for the murder of Branbridge pensioner Georgina Edmonds has been refused leave to appeal against his conviction. Matthew Hamlin, who has been locked up for at least 30 years, has failed to convince top judges that he was the victim of a miscarriage of justice. In 2012, Hamlin, 37, of Camborne Close, Bishopstoke, was cleared of murdering 77-year-old Mrs. Edmonds at her riverside cottage 4 years earlier. But he was rearrested in 2014 following a relaxation of the double jeopardy law that had previously prevented anyone being tried for the same crime twice. Earlier this year, Hamlin was convicted at Winchester Crown Court after prosecutors announced that the new DNA evidence linked him to the crime. At the Court of Appeal last Friday, his lawyers said jurors should not have been told about the first trial or when it took place because it prejudiced his defence. But three of the country's most senior judges said the information was relevant to the jury's considerations and did not make his trial unfair. Mrs. Edmonds was battered to death after being tortured for her PIN number. After the first trial, the blouse she wore when murdered was retested for DNA traces and a match was found to Hamlin. During the second trial, Mr. Justice Spencer ruled that jurors should be told about the case, as not telling them could lead to speculation regarding the long delay in the new evidence emerging. On Friday, William Moseley, QC for Hamlin, said letting the jury know there had been a previous trial and the date of it had shone a spotlight on the fresh DNA evidence, he said. Mr. Moseley added, it also raised the possibility of the jury considering the applicant had got away with murder at the trial and may have strengthened the resolve to convict. But Lord Justice Fulford said the information was relevant and the judge was entitled to rule that the jury should know. Sitting with Mrs. Justice Chima Grubb and Judge Peter Collier, QC, he added, there was a substantial gap between the examination of the blouse in 2010 and the next in 2014. In our view, a significant mystery would otherwise have been created and would undoubtedly have had to be addressed. We do not consider that this application for leave to appeal is arguable. Hamlin's family remain convinced he is innocent and have offered a £25,000 reward for new information leading to his conviction being squashed. They were unavailable for comment.
Welcome boost for carriage cafe plan. Plans for a cafe in an old railway carriage at a Winchester beauty spot have been given a major boost. Sitting on the Viaduct Way between Garnier Road and St Catherine's Hill, the Handlebar Cafe proposal has been created by youngsters to give visitors a place to enjoy a coffee before or after enjoying one of Winchester's most scenic routes. The scheme has now been approved by planners on the South Downs National Park Authority, and it's hoped that the cafe will open its doors next summer. The location is the old Southampton-Newbury railway line, which closed in 1965 and is now part of the National Cycle Network. To fit in with the history, the plans are for two carriages designed to replicate two trains passing, making space for a cafe, balcony outside seating and bike repair shop. The teenagers have impressed civic chiefs and receive support from Winchester Town Forum as well as Architecture PLB, based in St Thomas Street. The cafe will be run as a community interest company by Winchester-based Bespoke Biking and expand the range of opportunities and access to their services. Mark Drury, co-director of SPUD Spud Charity behind the scheme, said, "We're delighted that we have planning approval for it to go ahead. We've had incredible support from Winchester City Council and the South Downs, who are now talking to us about helping. Everyone is really excited and getting behind it. We're still in the middle of conversations about lots of funding from authorities, and we're about to launch a funding campaign. It is now not a case of if, but when it will be built, and our ambition is to have it open by next summer. Spud Youth is looking for interested companies and individuals who would like to support the project. Visit spudgroup.org.uk, or you can email mark@spudgroup.org.uk.
I thank you all for those. And we're going to go on to the death notices now. I'll begin with the first one, Bacon. Doreen Bacon, peacefully at home on the 28th of October, aged 85.
Bazin, Michael Bazin, suddenly on 19th October.
Betteridge, Roger William Betteridge, passed peacefully on the 21st of October, aged 65.
Davis, Christopher Robert Chris Davis, passed away peacefully on the 20th of October, aged 76.
Ferguson, Ronald Ferguson, suddenly but peacefully at home on the 31st of October, aged 92.
Fully Love, George Fully Love, peacefully on 21st October.
Harrison, Margaret Harrison, peacefully in Dower House Nursing Home on the 29th of October, aged 99.
Hatch, Ron Hatch, 17th of October, aged 91.
Hawkins Bias, Julie Elizabeth Hawkins Bias, aged 77, peacefully surrounded by her family on the 23rd of October.
Jones, Gwen Jones, suddenly at home on 21st October, aged 85.
Mitchell, Patricia Joan Mitchell, passed away peacefully at home on the 28th of October, aged 83.
Nuttall, Trevor John Nuttall, peacefully on 24th of October.
Rowe, Jack Rowe, formerly of Eve Stores, Littleton, died peacefully on the 23rd of October, aged 95.
Sawyer, Julian Adams, Jules Sawyer, passed away on 13th October, aged 57.
Star, Hilda Jane Julia Star, peacefully on the 29th of October, aged 95.
Thomas, David Griffith Thomas, passed away on the 29th of October, aged 91.
Wilmot, Jane Wilmot, at home on the 22nd of October, aged 96. Claire is going to read Christian comment for us now, which this week is contributed by Mary Gray.
And she has headed her item, Remembering Our Loved Ones. November the 2nd was the Feast of All Souls, not such a well-known feast as All Saints, yet popular across the Christian world, sometimes known as Day of the Dead. Biblically, our Western tradition looks to the second book of Maccabees. The custom of setting apart a special day on November the 2nd for intercession for loved ones was first established by St. Odilo of Cluny. From Cluny, the custom spread to other houses of the Cluniac order. This celebration grew throughout the Western Church, accepted in Rome in the 14th century. While November the 2nd remained the liturgical celebration, soon the entire month of November became associated with prayer for the dead. Lists of names of those to be remembered were placed near the altar, and this tradition endures to our day. Peter Damiani tells the story of the feast in his Life of Saint Odilo. A pilgrim returning from the Holy Land was cast by a storm on a desolate island. A hermit living there told him that amid the rocks was a chasm communicating with purgatory, from which perpetually rose the groans of tortured souls. The hermit also claimed he had heard the demons complaining how successful were the prayers of the faithful, especially the monks of Cluny, in rescuing their victims. Returning home, the pilgrim hastened to inform the abbot of Cluny, who then set the second day of November as the day of intercession for all the souls in purgatory. Among Eastern Orthodox and Catholic Christians, there are several All Souls' Days during the year. At the Reformation, the celebration of All Souls' Day was fused with All Saints' Day in the Anglican Church, but its observance was restored with the 1980 Alternative Service Book. Among continental Protestants, its tradition has been more tenaciously maintained. Even Luther's influence was not sufficient to abolish its celebration. Though church approval lapsed even in the Lutheran Church, its memory survived strongly in popular custom. Just as it is the custom of the French people to decorate the graves of their dead on this day, so German and Polish people stream to the graveyards once a year with offerings of flowers and grave lights. Among Czech people, the custom of visiting graves of relatives on the day is quite common, even among atheists. I saw this when living in Belgium. The local cemetery was a hive of activity. In North America, there is a more secular tradition, celebrated through Halloween. The origins of All Souls' Day in European folklore is related to worldwide customs of ancestor veneration. In Brittany, people flock to the cemeteries at nightfall to kneel bareheaded at the graves of their loved ones, anointing the tombstone with holy water. At bedtime, supper is left on the table. So many customs worldwide point to that human love stretching beyond the grave, ultimately trusting our loved ones to the care and tenderness of the eternal God. And Mary Gray wrote that.
Thank you, Claire. And we're going to move on to letters to the editor now. And we have 9 for you this week. Richard, would you start us off with the first, please?
Yes, which is headed Carry Out a Probe. And it comes from Robert Atkins, chairman of the Alsford Town Trust. So I refer to recent letters written by Mrs. Lucy Hodder to the Chronicle under the headings Rotten Council and Sorry State. I can now add my update to the problems listed by Mrs. Hodder. The Alsford Recreation Centre bar manager has complete control over staff wages and purchases, which is contrary to Alsford Town Council's financial regulations. In September, bar wages exceeded 50% of sales, a record, and the Town Council refuses to answer my question as to why this has occurred. The profits are a paltry £500 for the 6 months, against £14,000 for the first 6 months of last year. No explanation. The Town Council chairwoman, Lisa Griffiths, has a budgeted profit of £21,000 for this year, but no explanation as to how it is to be achieved from the £500 level. More surprisingly, 4 town councillors, Barrett, Kerr Smiley, Gower and Saunders, have refused to approve the monthly payments for the last 3 months, as they're not satisfied with the procedures, like the responsible financial officer's ability to sign payments herself. the responsible financial officer, Mrs. Kavanagh, needs to be replaced by a qualified accountant to ensure that the systems and controls are in place. The BDO are still auditing the accounts to March the 31st, 2016, having qualified the previous 3 years' accounts. What a lack of control over public money. I want BDO to carry out a full investigation as soon as possible. Robert Atkins, FCA, qualified 49 years. Chairman, Alsford Town Trust, Lindley Gardens, Alsford.
This letter is from Evelyn Parker and is headed Civilians Get Hurt. What is the white poppy for? Remembrance Day originated with a suggestion by a colonial secretary in South Africa and King George's dedication of 11th of November as a day for remembrance. At first, it was dedicated to grieving families, but as time went by, the war seemed more distant and the ceremony became more of a military ceremony. The British Legion adopted the red poppy as part of its poppy appeal in 1921, raising £100,000. Lest we forget was the motto. It was at that time that many feared that remembrance was close to a glorification of war. The Cooperative Women's Guild shared that concern and in 1933 pioneered the manufacture of white poppies by co-op workers. The women started wearing white poppies as a pledge to peace building and in consideration of civilian deaths. The bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 1945 and the massive civilian casualties of World War II marked the beginning of a shift in the conduct of warfare. Increasingly, in conflicts all over the world, it is non-combatants who die, are left wounded, or left destitute. Landmines, cluster bombs, aerial bombardment, armed drones, etc., leave what is referred to as collateral damage in their wake. It is these innocent civilians, many of them children, that wearers of a white poppy, or a red one and a white one together, are thinking about, as a symbol of hope for a change in international perceptions and relationships. Evelyn Parker, Winchester Quaker Peace and Justice Group, Colebrook Street, Winchester.
This letter from Dr. Fred Haslam is entitled City is Declining. My wife and I have lived in the Winchester area now for nigh on 30 years. Over the past 10 or so, we have watched with much sadness the slow but steady decline in what I would call the quality of the city centre. We only go into the city now on Tuesdays to avoid the mayhem which destroys the otherwise pleasant atmosphere during the rest of the week. Not just the market stalls, but the nature of what is for sale, and the awful pollution that destroys what was such a pleasant atmosphere. Moreover, the car parks can only be occupied if the traders' vans are not there. Why? What we regard as the decent shops have gone, or are going, and the centre is losing its character as it becomes just like any other run-of-the-mill English town. Contrast this all with Alsford, with its market just once a week and its unique shopping experience, showing Winchester just where it should be going. Oh dear. Dr. Fred Haslam, Shona Hill, Marterworthy.
And this letter from Councillor Gottlieb says, excavate site. Sir, I have no argument with Professor Martin Biddle, Chronicle, October the 27th. It was, after all, I who invited him to address the new Central Winchester Regeneration Committee. It was possibly that action that prompted my dismissal as its chairman. It seems that in my absence, the council sought to persuade Professor Biddle that it can't afford to excavate the site and to assure him that its development will not destroy more than 2% of what he confirms is archaeology of very great importance beneath the whole Silver Hill site. I wish I could be confident about such assurances, but I can't. I'm mindful of the judicial review of the independent inquiry and of the evidence of the council's previous efforts. When the Brookes was developed, two-thirds of what was described as the most important medieval excavation in Europe was destroyed. Any structural assessment of the Henderson proposal for Silver Hill would reveal that the archaeology would be extensively destroyed by foundations, by service trenches, and piles a metre wide and 22 metres deep. The strength of the council's assurances on heritage is revealed by its intended demolition of the Cross Keys passage and of the antiques market. Both remain under threat. Professor Biddle's further advice when describing the archaeology of Silver Hill is that, 1, we don't know what it consists of, 2, we don't know where on the site it is located, and 3, there is no means of discovering what and where it is without excavating the site. Money's just a matter of will, and if anything, the high future development value of the site makes a full excavation even more viable. There may also be scope to commercially exploit the archaeology by exhibiting it under glass floors, or by following the innovative solutions found by many other cities. Having been excommunicated by Councillor Godfrey on the basis of specious allegations by an aggrieved chief executive, it seems that my argument will remain with the council, as there is a real suspicion that it's aiming towards a third version of the Henderson scheme. Kim A. Gottlieb, Winchester City Councillor for Alresford and Itchen Valley, East Stratton.
This letter from Peter Rees is entitled Halt the Pollution. The recent announcement regarding parking in the city centre at Christmas is unsurprising, but it belies a cavalier attitude to residents. 60 Friarsgate parking places are just the beginning of Tory council plans to create even more centre car parking. Complicit in this major threat to public health is excessive Winchester BID pressure, representing city traders. There is a sustained pattern emerging where total disregard about poor air quality and life in the city is evident. The council has endlessly reneged on its promise to close at least 4 city centre car parks, conditions achieved when park and rides were being considered. BID claim that trading in the city will not survive unless it is swamped by cars again. There's no plan to improve public transport and no evidence of park and ride under capacity being strategically addressed. Their joint answer is to overwhelm the city centre with even more cars, a veritable tsunami of pollution ready to hit the city where air quality is already illegal and causes the deaths of 40 to 50 people per year. The BID says this is the price that has to be paid for the car being the single most important factor regarding trade. Councillor Burns says there has to be a balance between business and residents. Car emissions slowly kill people who presumably won't then be able to complain or support businesses. The policy of keeping death on the roads is alive and well in Winchester, despite the fact that 95% of polluted UK air comes from vehicles. Annually, more UK people die from polluted air-related conditions than traffic accidents. Whilst trade is important to the city, people's lives are much more so. There will never be a Winchester trader who isn't forever complaining about too few customers. Until the council decides that residents have a right to life and embody that protection into preventative traffic planning, ensuring park and ride is expanded, people will continue to die for the profit of a few. Peter Rees, former leader of the WCC Labour Group, Monarch Way, Winchester.
This letter is from the trustees of Friends of the Family and is headed, What Fine Support. As a small local charity, Friends of the Family depends on volunteers and the goodwill of the city and its businesses. Of late, the charity has held successful fundraising events, enabling us to continue to support vulnerable families and their children in Winchester. These fundraising efforts would not have been as successful without the support of Winchester businesses, including the Corner House, Gandhi's Restaurant, TSB, and the team at St John's House. We thank them all for all they have done. Always due our gratitude are the Quaker Meeting House, the Salvation Army, our programme leaders and all our volunteers. And that's from the trustees of Friends of the Family, care of the Meeting House, Colebrook Street, Winchester.
The church wardens of St John the Baptist Church, Alsford, wish to draw our attention to grave problems. As church wardens of St John's, Alsford, we feel we should bring to the attention of local residents the rather grave, forgive the pun, situation regarding the need for a cemetery in Alsford in the future. At present, there is burial space for perhaps 10 years in the churchyard at St John's, beyond which the alternative will be Mourne Hill, at considerable extra cost, and which is much further away for relatives. Space for cremated remains is also rapidly being filled. The cost of a single burial space at Mourne Hill is currently £4,000 for residents from outside Winchester. There's a 50% discount for local Winchester people. When the Sunhill development proposals in Alsford were published, there was a suggestion that an additional burial area would be included in the plans, which is not now the case, and little interest has been shown in using this additional area as a cemetery in a recent Alsford Town Council survey. We do not know what the cost of burials in Alsford would be if a new cemetery comes into being, but hopefully for local residents it would be less than the cost at Mourne Hill. We felt this situation should be brought to further public attention so that people in Alsford will be aware of the situation in the future when our churchyard is full. Roger Page and Jackie Connell, Church Wardens, St John the Baptist Church, Alsford.
A letter from Adam Nicholas is headed Focus on Community, Not Balance Sheet. It is indeed interesting that Catherine Turnis of Winchester Business Improvement District keeps patting herself on the back for failure on the high street, and that Winchester is the Christmas capital, a benchmark model for a BID. With up to 15 rough sleepers on the high street, you'd be lucky to find a bench. If this, the Brooks and King's Walk, is Miss Turnis's idea of a model, then I wouldn't trust her with a number two Meccano set. And now the Christmas market is doing food and drink packages to enhance the skating experience, putting a further squeeze on the high street. With obvious concerns about obesity, the high street has much healthier options. I suggest that these outlets start a petition stating how many they employ all year round and send it to Winchester Cathedral, the same cathedral that keeps passing the buck for any complaints from the public onto the organisers. Like it or not, the organisers represent Christmas at the cathedral. After all, they went through a very time-consuming process before they appointed a new dean to replace James Atwell. Let us pray that the new dean, the very Reverend Catherine Ogle, who takes up her post in February, embraces the wider community instead of focusing on a balance sheet. Adam Nicholas, Paintersfield, St Cross, Winchester.
This letter is from Sue Webb, alumni secretary of Pilgrim School, and the letter is headed Pilgrim School is Much Younger. The Pilgrim School was not founded over 450 years before Winchester College, Chronicle Letters, October 27. However, over a period of many hundreds of years, there had been attempts to educate the Winchester Cathedral choristers. But until the Pilgrim School opened on Friday, September the 18th, 1931, there had been no establishment that provided a modern education, not only in singing and music, but also in academic subjects and sport. The school opened with just 22 boys. 16 choristers, 5 probationers, and a day boy. The choristers came over to number 3, the Close, from a previous attempt to educate them at number 9, Dome Alley, in the Close. For an account of the first 50 years of the school and earlier establishments, I recommend John Crook's book, The History of the Pilgrim School. Sue Webb, The Pilgrim School, The Close, Winchester.
And we're going to return to Jerry now with a letter with a quite unusual request.
Which is made by Anne Gildersleeve and is headed Deflower Rapists. I read the interesting article by Chronicle Editor-in-Chief Ian Murray on how the Norman Conquest changed Hampshire and noted that in Anglo-Saxon times a rapist would be castrated. I think this punishment would be a far better deterrent than a prison sentence for rapists. So bring back castration. Anne Gildersleeve, Cripstead Lane, St Cross, Winchester.
Thank you, Jerry. Who says the letters don't have a variation in interest? And it's back to Jerry again with the roving reporter's question to locals on the high street. And they ask who they'd like to see as BBC Sports Personality of the Year. Announcement to be made on the 18th of December. Jerry has their answers.
Yes, Rob Veck, 62, chairman of Colden Common Tennis Club, said, "Well, I think Andy Murray. Our vision statement at the tennis club here is that the next Andy Murray could come from our club, and I think he's an inspiration." Amanda James, 53, of Church Row, Branbridge, said, "I think Andy Murray should be, because he's an inspiration to young people and British sport." Richard Izzard, 67, a city and parish councillor of Hack Drive, Colton Common, said, "Andy Murray, he's helped a lot of younger people get into sport and given youngsters a chance." And Martin Larkin, 71, retired of Veers Lane, Colton Common. Oh, he said, "I think Ben Stokes the cricketer should be. He turns around matches. He's a real match winner in his own right, and I like that."
Thank you, Jerry. Well, I wonder who you'd vote for. Now, if you have an opinion or a subject you'd like to air in the Hampshire Chronicle, you can contact them on 01962 860 8836, 01962 860 836, or email news@hampshirechronicle.co.uk. As usual, lowercase, no spaces, news@hampshirechronicle.co.uk, or you could also write to the editor at 5 Upper Brook Street, Winchester, SO23 8AL. And following all the letters, we're going to now have editorial comment, which this week covers the World Heritage Site vision, a real coup, it says. Alan Lovell and the Hampshire Cultural Trust should be applauded for their ambition in aiming to make Winchester a World Heritage Site. But they have to convince UNESCO, the United Nations Educational, Scientific and Cultural Organisation, which, as Mr. Lovell conceded, may be difficult. There are relatively few places so recognised in Britain. Stonehenge is probably the best known, along with Canterbury Cathedral, Durham Castle and Cathedral, Blenheim Palace and the Forth Bridge. It is probable that the Trust, which took over the running of Hampshire County Council and Winchester City Council's museums in 2014, would never have had the idea were it not for the resurgence of interest in Winchester's Anglo-Saxon and medieval past, sparked by the Hyde 900, founded by the local resident Edward Fennell. The growing interest in King Alfred has stoked a wider interest in this city's rich heritage, as the seat of kings, the seat of sieges and battles, and one of the maternity units for the English language. That interest has increased knowledge of our past, an intrinsic part of our culture. Should Winchester secure the status with the massive publicity for its tourist attractions and resulting economic boost, then Mr. Fennell should be recognised in an honours list. Now we've got Belgarum. Jerry has the first item this week, and it's headlined Running for Stroke Cash.
A man from Chandler's Ford helped raise more than £1,000 to help stroke sufferers. Liam Stapleton pounded the streets of Portsmouth as he completed the Great South Run in less than 2 hours to help the Stroke Association. The cause is very close to the heart of the 52-year-old father of three, a former secondary school teacher. Mr. Stapleton had a stroke on Christmas Day in 2014. It left him unable to speak and move the right side of his body. However, he's made a remarkable recovery and has since lost over 5 stone and regularly takes part in local races. Liam said, 2 years ago, I never would have dreamed that I could run a mile, let alone 10. The run was fantastic. I really enjoyed every minute of it. Almost randomly, I got into fitness following my stroke. 8 weeks of exercise and I was a new man with muscular arms, 50% lower on my body fat, and the most flexible I'd ever been. I started attending the Stroke Association support group in Velmore in June last year and realised how lucky I'd been. Attending the group boosted my confidence immensely. I knew I was among friends and could be honest about my experiences. Interacting with others in similar situations gave me the strength to continue fighting.
Panic for pubs is exaggerated. Belgarum has mentioned before the threat to local pubs and how national pub campaigners repeatedly overstate their hand. Excuse me. Regularly there are mentions about the rates of closure. 20, 30, 50 a week. Some doom-laden statistic that predicts the last pub will disappear in 2042. In the Winchester area, there have been two more pub closures for the Campaign for Real Ale to bemoan. Except there aren't. The King Charles in Kingsworthy has been empty for 2 weeks and so technically might be said to have closed. In fact, Fuller's, the owner, says it's due to reopen with new tenants. At Crawley, the Fox and Hounds has been closed for a year, but negotiations are taking place with a new purchaser. Many pubs have closed in Winchester in the last 25 years. The Chimneys in Wick, the Eagle Hotel on City Road, the Heart in Hand, Mash Tun, New Queen's Head, Stanmore Hotel and the Prince of Wales spring to mind. A sad decline, but not catastrophic.
Epitaph for Alfred. Eagle-eyed readers may have spotted a rather unusual in memoriam in last week's edition of the Chronicle. Arguably Winchester's biggest and certainly most enduring icon, King Alfred was remembered with a spot in the paper, which remembered his death on October the 26th, 899. The memoriam stated, King Alfred, 899, Passing of King Alfred the Great, father and founder of England. On social media, a picture of the section was put on Winchester Pix, which is a popular Facebook group for residents in the city, and it received 227 likes. One person wrote, "Shows how much Alfred is thought of in Winchester." Another said, 1,117 years ago? Amazing! Well done, Hampshire Chronicle. Also, to mark the occasion, there were flowers placed by Alfred's statue in the Broadway. Although the great king was never forgotten, his profile in recent years has been raised by the work of the community group Hyde 900 in seeking to discover more about Hyde Abbey, the monarch's final resting place.
And as always in this spot, we are moving to historical items with the usual mini news clips, and that's starting with 200 years, which is my slot. 200 years ago, November the 4th, 1816. Industrial unrest. It appears by letters from Newport that a party of the Merthyr rioters had gone into Monmouthshire with the intention of putting out the blast at the furnace at Blaenwen and getting the workmen there to join them. The men belonging to the iron works, who refused to work on account of wages, endeavoured to seduce the workmen at the collieries. Mr. Merrick, solicitor to the bench of magistrates at Merthyr, has written to contradict the statement that the workmen had been reduced to the wages of 1 shilling per day. Nonetheless, he states that 10 shillings per week were earned, and the miners and colliers had at least 15 shillings per week. And the second item under 200 years ago. Naval dry rot. The experiment about to be made at Plymouth by sinking ships as a preventative of the dry rot is by no means a new idea. There has not been a ship built at Whitby for many years which has not been sunk in salt water with a view of guarding them against that great evil to shipping, and which has never known to fail in the desired effect. At Hull, also, this practice has become pretty general. At Liverpool, it is known that ships sometimes in the habit of taking cargoes of salt on board are never subject to dry rot. The crevices in the ship, being closed up with salt, will prevent them from any attack of the fungus for many years.
100 years ago, November the 4th, 1916, military suicide. The mystery surrounding the disappearance from the camp at Flowerdown of QMS Henty Davy, RGA, was cleared up by the finding of his dead body in a hedge last Friday. An inquest on the body was held by Henry White, Esquire, County Coroner, at Hursley on Tuesday. Police Constable Payne spoke of being called to see the body. The deceased was lying on his left side, with a razor clinched tightly in his left hand. The throat was cut from ear to ear, severing the windpipe and both carotid arteries. He had been 13 years in the army and bore an exemplary character. Verdun success. The latest news from the seats of war is brighter all round. The Kaiser's troops have been compelled to evacuate Fort Vaux at Verdun. This is the result of the brilliant French victory of October the 24th, when our ally won back, at insignificant cost, almost the whole of the ground it had taken the Germans many months to capture at the expense of at least 500,000 casualties. The review of the operations on the British front by Sir Douglas Haig, published on Thursday, gives ground for satisfaction, while the news of the splendid victory of the Italians on the Carse, where they took nearly 5,000 prisoners, will be welcomed on all hands.
Rather more mundanely, from 50 years ago, November the 5th, 1966, free parking cut. Winchester is to lose the hour's free parking in its main car parks, and the annual season ticket of £10 will become 2 6-monthly tickets of £8, the City Council decided on Wednesday evening. The Highways Committee, in considering charges for the new multi-storey car park, decided to recommend the increases so that the multi-storey car park could become self-supporting. After 6 months for the first hour, the charges will be the same as they are now. 1 shilling for the second hour, 2 shillings for the third hour, and 3 shillings over 3 hours. If only. Vulnerable targeted. The police forces of this area appeal for assistance of all members of the public to stop a series of very mean and cowardly thefts from the elderly and infirm. Recent cases include one where 3 bogus rating officials called on a 77-year-old cripple living alone. These men told the old gentleman that they were from the rating office of the local council and that a rebate of rates was due. On a pretext, they examined his house and stole £50, all of his savings. In another case, 2 men posing as bank officials called on an elderly lady regarding her bank account. It was later discovered that 2 cheques were missing from her chequebook.
25 years ago, November the 1st, 1991. Unemployment up. There is growing concern in Hampshire over unemployment in the county. With an increase of 94% in adult unemployment in the past year, statistics show an 80% increase in jobless school leavers in the same period. Winchester comes out best with a 25% increase in its unemployment figures, followed by Portsmouth and Cosham, each with a 50% increase. Both Andover and Southampton have doubled their figure, and Alton and Lymington give most cause for concern by registering 150% increases. Social workers angry. Angry social workers worried about cuts in services disrupted Monday's meeting of Hampshire County Council's Policy and Resources Committee. The social workers waited through 1.5 hours of discussion about Calshot Activities Centre, and then one got up to complain that the item about funding for social services had not been discussed. "You're interfering," he was told by committee chairman, Mr. Freddie Emery Wallace. "Only councillors and council officers are allowed to speak at the meeting." "We are leaving because we have to go to work," the man said, and then left with 20 or so of his colleagues.
And thank you all for those. Jerry and Richard now have got a couple of articles, and the first one's Jerry, "A Winchester Hoard of Treasures."
Yes, the Winchester Hoard is returning to the city in a royal exhibition. Iron Age jewellery discovered in Hampshire is among the exhibits at a new exhibition starting in Winchester this month. The Winchester and Alton hoards return to Hampshire for the Births, Battles and Beheadings exhibition, celebrating the county's royal past, at the gallery in the Discovery Centre. The exquisite Winchester hoard was discovered in a field near the city in 2000 and consists of two sets of elaborate gold jewellery, each set comprising a necklace torque, bracelet and two brooches linked with a chain. This is only the second time that the hoard has been on display in its home county and only the fourth time nationally. The Alton hoard also dates from the Iron Age, and a gold ring, bracelet and 20 representative gold staters or coins are a highlight of the exhibition. That hoard was discovered in 1996 and has not previously been on show outside the British Museum, which has loaned both hoards to the Hampshire Cultural Trust, the exhibition's organiser. Births, Battles and Beheadings focuses on six key periods in Hampshire's history. From the Iron Age through to the Anglo-Saxons, Tudors and Stuarts, each period is explored through a spectacular array of objects and artefacts. Among those pieces making their public debut are a pendant found near Odiham, which belonged to the influential Despenser family, 120 silver coins hidden in a cottage in Dummer during the English Civil War, and a stunning 700-year-old gold, sapphire and garnet ring acquired for the Winchester City Council collection this year. The exhibition will also feature the Monk Sherborne Buckle, one of the finest pieces of Anglo-Saxon craftsmanship to have been found in Hampshire, and a rare Byzantine pail discovered at Bremer, one of only three of its type in Britain. Also on display will be eight costumes representing the different historical periods, which have been designed and made especially for the exhibition in a collaboration with theatre costume design students from Bournemouth University. The exhibition travels back in time and explores the history of England's kings and queens who have left an indelible mark. Gallery exhibits will allow visitors a close-up look at priceless rare objects dating back to 400 BC and through the Iron Age, Roman, Saxon, Norman, Angevin, Tudor and Stuart periods. Riveting reenactments and outdoor performances will transport everyone from curious kids to history buffs back to the heart of illustrious battles, terrifying sieges and opulent banquets. Hampshire has played host to many crucial moments in English history, and the events will both educate and excite visitors about our county. Janet Owen, Chief Executive of Hampshire Cultural Trust, said, "We are absolutely thrilled to be staging this remarkable exhibition. It's given us a unique opportunity not only to bring the Winchester and Alton hoards back home, but also to showcase some of the spectacular objects found in Hampshire, which belong to both the Hampshire County Council and Winchester City Council collections, cared for by the Hampshire Cultural Trust." Births, Battles and Beheadings is part of Royal Blood, the Fight for Power in Hampshire, the Trust's year-long county-wide programme of exhibitions, performances and events, exploring the county's long and illustrious royal history. Admission to the exhibition is free, and it can be seen at the Discovery Centre from Saturday, November the 5th, until Sunday, January the 8th, 2017. Also at the Discovery Centre, as part of Royal Blood, is City Under Siege, an exhibition telling the story of Winchester's defences, from the Romans right through to the Civil War. Admission to that is also free, and that exhibition runs until December the 4th.
Thank you, Gerry. And with historical items, we're going to give the final one to Richard. I don't think I want to read the heading. Thank you. Over to you.
Granny dropped toddler down well. Child at Great Hall heard about the horrific killing by a grandmother of her toddler grandson. The conviction was inevitable. So too was the sentence. Guilty, but insane. What else could a jury decide about a troubled woman who cast her grandson down the village well? An even greater solemnity than normal hung over the Great Hall at Winchester, as the horrific sequence of events were detailed as to how Claire Bain, 50, had murdered 17-month-old Stanley Watts. This is about as distressing a case as it would be possible for counsel for the prosecution to unfold, but the understandable opening remarks of Barrister Charles Duke. Bain had been confined to an asylum in 1925, suffering from melancholia and suicidal tendencies, but was released 2 years later in the belief that she'd been cured. Mental illness had run in the family, her father having taken his own life, and her aunt was also confined. Days later, her daughter left home to go to work at a house opposite, leaving the baby in the care of her sister and mother. She returned later that morning, and the child was all right. Bain refused dinner and went out, saying that she would look after Stanley. She took him with her, and the poor little child was never seen alive again. Mr. Bain came home a quarter of an hour later and went to find his wife. Instead, he found his mother-in-law in a meadow, standing opposite a fence, and when he asked her where his son was, she admitted she'd dropped him down the well. The grief-stricken father immediately took her to the police station and told a constable what she'd said. "That's quite right," she concurred, without a trace of emotion. He returned home and scaled down the 80-foot-deep well to bring up his son, but without success. Another man later did. Bain was examined by the local GP. He asked her what made her do it, and she said she didn't know, said Dr. Roberts. "I held him by the armpits over the well, and he laughed. Something came over me, and I dropped him down the well, and he fell into the water. I asked her if she appreciated that she'd committed murder, and she replied that her daughter had told her she'd done a wicked thing. I thought she was a woman who was not responsible for her actions." Bain, who lived at Odiham, was committed to stand trial at Hampshire Assizes, appearing before Mr. Justice Shearman on November the 15th, 1928. The evidence went virtually unchallenged, apart from Dr. Roberts, who confirmed that Bain had initially told him. The only other witness called was Dr. Richards, medical officer at Winchester Prison. "I kept her under observation and have come to the conclusion she's suffering from depression and melancholia." Bain was ordered to be detained during His Majesty's pleasure.
Thank you, Richard. And we'll move on now to what's on. And, of course, we're at that time of the year when we start to plan our Christmas activities. And, naturally, the paper is full of items to lead you into the season, which I hope will cheer you up a little. There's one item first of, headed the 12 Days of Christmas. After the storming success of last year's first Woolly Hat Fair, the festival is back in December with a new seasonal event. The team behind 2015's live advent calendar will create a city-wide version of the 12 Days of Christmas, all in characteristic Hat Fair style. 12 events will be staged throughout December, each in a different location and each inspired by one of the days of Christmas. Michelle Walker, artistic director of Hat Fair, said, "Day one will be based on a partridge in a pear tree. Day two will be inspired by two turtle doves, all the way through to the glorious finale of 12 drummers drumming. Events at Woolly Hat Fair will be free to attend and will take place at 5 p.m. on Saturdays, Sundays, Tuesdays and Thursdays between the 3rd and the 22nd of December. The Woolly Hat Fair is organised by Hat Fair, the UK's longest-running outdoor arts festival, which takes place annually in Winchester, and that's always during the first week in July. Full details of the 12 Days of Christmas events will be revealed on, and this is a website address, hatfair.co.uk. That's hatfair.co.uk. So we'll stay with the Christmas activities, and I must say the papers focus so much on it, we've got very little else to tell you about. But these are good items. The first I'm going to tell you about is headed BBC Sally to host Cathedral Concert. Tickets are now on sale for this year's Winchester Cathedral Concert with special guest host Sally Taylor. Taking place on Friday, December the 9th, the organisers say they are delighted to have the BBC South Today presenter back for another year. Also returning are celebrated opera singers Claire Rutter and Stephen Gadd, who are former chorister parents, so it promises to be a real family affair this year. All of the artists will be singing the usual mix of traditional and more light-hearted carols interspersed with readings and reflections. And organisers say it's advisable to book well in advance for this increasingly popular event. Speaking recently about the concert, Ms Taylor said that she is delighted to be asked again and delighted to be involved, and I'm sure it will be a lovely evening. So that's on Friday, the 9th of December. It's at Winchester Cathedral at 7:30 p.m. And the event is entitled Christmas Carol Concert by Winchester Cathedral Choristers. Information and tickets, and here's the number to ring. 01962 857 275. 01962 857 275. And the tickets are between £15 and £40. Now, the first big thing that happens to herald Christmas are the Christmas lights being switched on, and that's at 4:30 in the Broadway on Friday the 18th of November. And the Christmas market will be opened on that day at 6:30 p.m. So if you can go, Christmas lights are being switched on at 4:30, Friday the 18th of November, and the Christmas market opens. And judging by the traffic coming through Winchester, that will certainly herald Christmas with a bang. Saturday the 10th of December from at 12 o'clock until 3, the City Mill, Bridge Mill, is the Alder Valley Brass Band Christmas Concert. That's the Alder Valley Brass Band Christmas Concert, guaranteed to get you in the mood for Christmas. That's on Saturday the 10th of December at City Mill, Bridge Street. And information on that is 01962 870 057. 01962 870 057. Got one or two more for you. The Oh, in the Winchester Cathedral Outer Close. Oh, yes, this is good. The Winchester Cathedral Outer Close on Sunday the 11th of December at 6 o'clock, there will be carols on the green. Christchurch singers invite everyone to join them in singing their favourite Christmas carols. That's in the Outer Close of the Cathedral, carols on the green, Sunday the 11th at 6 p.m. And also, there are going to be pop-up shops selling Hampshire-made products, and that'll be at the City Mill Bridge Street and in the City Mill, City Museum, I'm sorry, in the square until Sunday the 18th of December. And just to give you a little break away from the Christmas items, that's what I want to say, going on Thursday the 10th of November, John Pilkington will be talking on Russia and Europe. What next? And that's at the Winchester Discovery Centre in Jury Street at 7 o'clock. That's John Pilkington. He is Winchester's well-known traveller and examines problems and issues of the Ukraine and breakaway status of the Caucasus. And he's talking in aid of End Polio Now. The tickets are £10. And the telephone number, if you want to go, is 01962 873 603. 01962 873 603. Thank you. So before we move on to the general news, I'll give you the following lighting up times. So starting on Saturday, the 5th of November, the sun will set at 4:32 p.m. On Wednesday, the 9th of November, the sun will rise at 7:12 a.m. and will set at 4:25 p.m. And those evenings have certainly drawn in, haven't they? So we're going to go on to items of general news. And Gerry will start with the first article, please.
Basics Bank is grateful for donations. It was a bumper harvest for Winchester Basics Bank. The charity, which provides emergency food and clothing to local people, was astounded by the generosity of residents with donations from around 50 churches, schools, supermarkets and other organisations in 2016, which proved to be a bumper year. Last year, the charity fed 2,994 clients with food for 5 days. 1,343 of those were children. Janet Crick, operations manager, said, "This is always a busy time for us, and our food bank stock was running very low on many items. Now we have a good supply of food to cover the winter months. We would like to take this opportunity to thank everyone who donated for making this harvest period such a success. In addition, we want to thank Waitrose and their customers for hosting 2 days of food collection at the end of September, which supplied us with around 40 crates. We're also grateful to the local supermarkets, Sainsbury's, Waitrose and Tesco's, who support us through the year with customer donations and the food donation partnership programmes. We could not offer our services without this wonderful support. The charity is currently looking for an alternative base, having outgrown their current office space in West Highcliffe."
Confusion could delay waste opening changes. Changes to Hampshire's waste recycling opening hours could be delayed following a rethink about the controversial plans. Hampshire County Council had been planning to reduce opening hours at the council's waste and recycling centres from January as part of a bid to save £98 million from its budget. However, a recent announcement from the government has caused council chiefs confusion. Councillor Rob Humby said, "The government compels us to reduce running costs, but at the same time seems to want to micromanage particular details of how we provide the service. In view of this uncertainty, I am considering delaying introducing any further changes. We know the County Council's HWRC service is efficient, well used by residents and the most cost-effective way to collect waste from Hampshire's households. All the sites have an admirable recycling rate, and Hampshire overall has an enviable record in the amount of waste diverted from landfill. We have left no stone unturned in finding ways to keep the HWRC service open as much as possible to residents while finding financial savings required by severe reductions in government funding. We have negotiated a new contract and opened up the HWRCs for small businesses to use for their trade waste for the first time, on a cost recovery basis. These are early days, but I am encouraged by the take-up of this new service, which is helping to meet the running costs of the HWRCs. We've tried to reduce costs in as fair a way as possible by introducing charging for non-household construction-type waste for residents. This means paying at the point of use for an extra service, as the County Council is not obliged to accept this sort of material and doesn't pass any additional costs to council taxpayers. However, even though many councils have been charging for non-household waste or not even accepted it for some years, a recent government press statement has threatened our savings plans by suggesting they may change the rules. So far, in line with residents' priority, we've managed to avoid closing any of the Hampshire sites and made financial savings by other means. But until we get some clarity from government ministers, we find ourselves in the perplexing position of potentially having to look again at our plans. In the meantime, it seems sensible to hold off bringing in any further changes.
Row over community centre splits village. It's the row that has split the village of Coldon Common. The parish council, which owns Coldon Community Centre but leases it to the community association, has vacated the building after refusing to pay for an hourly rate on a room that would not be exclusive to them. Both sides have been accusing the other of factual inaccuracies on social media, and villagers calling for both organisations to find a solution. Parish Council Chairman Richard Izzard, who signed the lease then, said it was in the spirit of the agreement that the council would have an office provided free of charge. However, the Coldon Common Community Association, CCCA, say that 80% of its revenue comes through room rental, and they asked the council to pay £6.50 per hour for the stage storeroom for 9 hours a week. The council declined over restricted non-exclusive access. The CCA said in a statement on Facebook that the council used the room as well as holding regular meetings without contributing to the centre, that the meetings mean the association can't book the rooms to paying customers. It says the council also used resources of the centre without making necessary contributions to the cost. This parish council are due to relocate to the pavilion at Boys Lane. The CCA will discuss the issue on November the 6th at 7 p.m. at the centre.
Dog rescue charity looks for new base. A Hampshire dog charity is appealing for a new home. The Hampshire and Surrey branch of the Retired Greyhound Trust, RGT, urgently needs to find a new site in order to continue running their homing kennels. The branch currently operates from kennels in Fleet in North Hampshire, but after 8 years at the site, the current owner is looking to retire and is selling the property, so the four-legged residents are urgently in need of a new place to stay. Nationally, the charity, also known as Greyhound Lifeline, homes nearly half of the 8,000 greyhounds that retire from racing each year. The Hampshire and Surrey branch finds owners for around 50 dogs yearly. Many greyhounds that can no longer run are put to sleep. Despite uncertain times, the team of volunteers, led by Marie Harris and Lucy Quarrenden, believe moving home will bring positive changes for the branch. Ms. Harris said, "The move is a prime opportunity to develop our team and look to provide even better facilities for our hounds. It's a chance to become even more professional and successful, to help even more greyhounds. There are so many greyhounds out there to help, we just need a location from which we can continue our mission." The branch houses around 17 dogs in its kennels at any one time and cares for a number of greyhounds in foster homes. As the Trust never puts a healthy dog down, RGT Hampshire and Surrey also care for Reggie, the sponsor dog, a greyhound with sight problems who's likely to stay with the team for long-term in foster care. The team are looking for a new base, ideally within 10 miles of Fleet, but locations further afield could be viable.
A-board removal will hit business. Concerns are growing that a civic clampdown on Winchester shops' advertising boards is badly hitting trade. The County Council has been ordering Parchment Street traders to remove the boards, saying they are a trip hazard for the elderly and people with disabilities. Councillor Rob Humby, Executive Member for Environment and Transport, said, "Following a number of complaints, our highways teams have written to some businesses in Parchment Street asking them to remove their A-boards, which can cause difficulties for people getting around, especially those with visual or mobility impairments, in wheelchairs or with young children in pushchairs. When an increasing number of A-boards are put out in a busy pedestrian area, it impacts on people's ability to move freely about the town, giving rise to complaints, and that's why we requested their removal." John Walker of Manteek in Stonemasons Court said he was worried about the impact of removing the boards. He said one neighbouring store had seen a 40% drop in trade from the removal, but others had seen business nearly double in a week with the addition of one. Catherine Turnus, Executive Director of Winchester BID, agreed with Mr. Walker, adding that the BID had been working hard to think of alternatives to the A-boards, including the introduction of wall-attached signs. However, the Cabinet Committee heard that a new A-board at the High Street end of the street will be placed by the County Council to display all the names of the shops in Parchment Street. Councillor Humby said a balance needed to be struck, and he was discussing the issue with Winchester BID to agree a solution where each business can display a single A-board which doesn't obstruct the public until permanent signing is in place.
Mission to bring water to millions. Every day we wash, brush our teeth, use the toilet and drink clean water without giving a second thought to how lucky we are. But for millions of people around the world, access to water suitable for drinking and sanitation is a basic human right that they are denied, with potentially deadly consequences. Richard Brown, a director at Chandler's Ford pump rental company Selwood, has seen firsthand how communities can be blighted by poor sanitation and can be transformed with a little help. He's returned from a 5,000-mile mission to Madagascar, one of the poorest countries in the world, as part of a campaign headed by Wessex Water and its partners in support of WaterAid. There, Richard and his fellow team members help dig canals, carry water and sand and build sanitation facilities, and also met many of the local villagers that the projects are helping. This was Richard's second visit to a WaterAid project area. In 2012, he was emotionally affected by the severe devastation he witnessed in Burkina Faso, caused by appalling sanitation there. "Nothing prepares you for seeing it at first hand," he says. "To visit somewhere where there is abject poverty, no water or sanitation is difficult and incredibly humbling. You see and hear of children who are ill and of people walking a long, long way to get water that isn't very clean anyway. You see people collecting water from a stream, and then minutes later, cows are standing there drinking and peeing in the same place. This is the best source of water these people have. I've seen babies that were forced to drink from a river bed that was almost dry. Most of us have children or grandchildren. To see that really hit home and made me think how lucky we are. That's one of the reasons why, following the visit to Burkina Faso, I was determined to try and help make a difference in Madagascar. WaterAid, a non-governmental organisation focused on improving access to safe water, sanitation and improved hygiene worldwide, has been working in Madagascar since 1999. Richard's trip was part of a £100,000 project focused on one of the worst affected areas, where WaterAid is helping to install gravity-fed systems to give villagers access to clean water for the first time.
Call made to public during Poppy Appeal. The Poppy Appeal 2016 has launched in Hampshire as the Royal British Legion encourages people to rethink remembrance during this year's campaign. The poppy and the work of the Legion are often associated with the First and Second World Wars and elderly veterans, but the charity is calling on the public to consider all generations of the armed forces when they wear their poppy. The call to think more widely about our armed forces when you make your donation this year came from Lieutenant General Sir Mark Manns, Deputy Lieutenant of Hampshire, and Councillor Jackie Vosper, Mayor of Rushmore, who launched the Legion's Hampshire Poppy Appeal at Prince's Mead Shopping Centre in Farnborough. Sir Mark Manns said, "During the Poppy Appeal this year, we're asking people to widen their lens when they reflect on remembrance. The Legion is here for all generations of the armed forces community, and it's important to remember there's a new generation that needs your support. When you pin your poppy on, or pause to remember, reconsider who you think of when you picture a veteran. Individuals and families from across the armed forces community need the Legion's support, as well as our older veterans. Every donation received will make a real difference to the lives of servicemen and women, veterans and their loved ones. The fundraising target in Hampshire is £1.5 million, which will go towards the Legion's national target of £43 million to continue its vital work delivering practical, through-life care and support to the armed forces community. In the last year, the generosity of the British public helped the Legion answer more than 780,000 requests for help.
Beale's Store. Negotiations are taking place over the empty Beale's department store in the Brook Centre in Winchester. Beale's, the flagship store in the centre for some 25 years, left in the summer, leaving the two-storey unit standing empty. The Chronicle understands that the owners of the Brooks are in advanced discussions with a well-known high street name to take over the unit, whose identity is currently undisclosed.
Oh. Tea and cakes at home with the Mayor. Mayor of Winchester, Jane Rutter, has been getting help for her new initiative of opening her official residence, Abbey House, to the public. Kitchen Dancers Women's Institute supported Councillor Rutter during the afternoon of her At Home initiative last month. Members of the public were invited to pop into Abbey House on the Broadway for tea, coffee and homemade cakes to meet the Mayor and have a mini tour of the Georgian mansion. The ladies from Kitchen Dancers WA made all the cakes, supplied the bunting and served the tea. A great time was had by all and a magnificent £130 raised for the Mayor's charities during the afternoon.
I wish I'd been there. Thank you very much, everybody. Well, that concludes our extracts from the Hampshire Chronicle for this week. And before we go on, I'll give you another reminder that Irene Dowding is the person to call if you have any problems with your recording. Just give you her number one more time. It's 01962 870 370. And we now thank all the support teams for the preparation and dispatch of this edition, and to our editors, Gordon and Liz. And, of course, many thanks to our readers, Claire.
Goodbye.
Richard.
Goodbye.
And Jerry.
Bye.
And from me, until next time, goodbye. Thank you. Would you please put the memory stick in the wallet when you've finished with it and return it to us as soon as possible? Thank you very much for listening and have a good week.